Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an expert on chemical weapons and look into why the Syrian regime has them, what they have, and who's in charge of them. Gregory Koblenz, a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs and a member of the Scientist Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss the impending U.S. strike on Syria over its use of chemical weapons against its own civilian population. Then we'll explore alternative scenarios to the punitive use of force in Syria and the possibility of President Obama using his visit to Russia for the G20 summit to sit down with Putin and find a way to end the bloody civil war in Syria rather than escalate it. Asher Kaufman, a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame, joins us to discuss what might end the bloodshed and destruction of Syria, short of a partition of the country that is not likely to produce viable states if the rebels end up with a landlocked rump state with no access to the Mediterranean. Then finally, we'll discuss the shadow of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney hanging over the Syrian intervention and the peculiar alliances between Democratic interventionists and Republican neoconservatives on one side and liberal Democrats and libertarian Republicans who are against the Syrian intervention on the other. Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, joins us to discuss today's strange political bedfellows and W.'s legacy of lies. And joining us now is Gregory Koblenz, who is a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs and Deputy Director of the Biodefense Graduate Program at George Mason University. He's also a research affiliate with the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a member of the Scientific Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Living Weapons, Biological Warfare and International Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Koblenz.
Thank you for having me.
And let's sort of begin in the beginning, if we can, with Syria's chemical weapons arsenal, which is fairly substantial. I take it that they have them in the first place as a deterrent against Israel's nuclear weapon. Is that why they have them in the first place?
That's correct. Syria started developing their own chemical weapons program in the 1980s in response to the threat they perceived from Israel, both on the from nuclear weapons and also from Israel's very large conventional military.
And why is it then that Israel has gone after Syria's weapons of mass destruction in terms of a North Korean reactor that they bombed some time back, but yet they've allowed this vast arsenal, which according to this new French report that's come out, there are several hundreds of tons of sulfur mustard, tens of tons of VX, and several hundreds of tons of sarin.
I mean, Israel has been very wary of any country in its neighborhood developing weapons of mass destruction, and they've gone to great efforts to prevent a lot of that proliferation. They put, I think, nuclear weapons, though, in a different category from chemical weapons, in part because there are defenses against chemical weapons. You can shoot down the missiles, you can have gas masks, you have antidotes to be used against them, so there are defenses available. You can mitigate the consequences of a chemical attack. But nuclear weapons, right, there is no real defense against them. They have enormous destructive capabilities, and so they pose a different kind of threat. So I think Israel maybe was focused more on the most dangerous threats they perceived, and that's why they went after the reactor, whereas the chemical weapons threat, while significant, is not on the same order of magnitude. And also, it's a much harder target to go after. The Syrians had one reactor that they were building. It took a very small airstrike for Israel to destroy it, but chemical weapon facilities can be dual-use facilities, can be industrial facilities. The Syrians reportedly have four or five of them, and so that maybe was a more difficult target to go after as well.
So the French apparently have provided a fairly comprehensive report that talks about the command and control of Syria's chemical weapons under a Syrian Air Force organization known as Unit 450. Tell me more. You've studied the report. So what's your sense of what we've learned there?
The French report is very detailed. It's actually more detailed than either the American or British reports have been released so far. And there's a lot of information about not just what kind of chemical weapons they have. And according to the French, they have, as you said earlier, they have mustard, sarin and VX, which are the last two are nerve agents, and they reportedly have those in binary form, which is a more sophisticated form of chemical weapon. And the Syrians have a range of delivery systems, rockets, missiles, aircraft-delivered bombs. And in addition, the French did discuss to limit extent some of the command and control arrangements around those weapons. And apparently the Syrian regime has entrusted an all Alawite unit. So this is a unit made up of people from the same sect that Bashar al-Assad is from, that are in charge with filling these weapons and securing them. And this is outside of the regular military chain of command.
And would that be similar to what Saddam Hussein had? Didn't he have people from his Tikrites, as they were called, those from his hometown?
Yeah, so it's actually very common for militaries to have two chains of command for dealing with either nuclear or chemical weapons. One is the regular military chain of command, which would have control over the delivery systems, such as the artillery or the airplane. And there'd be a separate unit, very elite, hand-picked so they're loyal to the regime first and foremost. In the case of Iraq, they were mostly Tikrites. In Syria, they're Alawites. In the Soviet Union, they were picking people based on their loyalty to the communist regime. And so by having two parallel chains of command here, it ensured these weapons could only be used when the leader gave the order. And this protects the leader from his own people using the weapons against him, or them getting out of control, or getting diverted, or used in an unauthorized way in somehow.
And again, I'm speaking with Gregory Koblenz, who's a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs and Deputy Director of the Biodefense Graduate Program at George Mason University. He's also a research affiliate with the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a member of the Scientist Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. And he's the author of Living Weapons, Biological Warfare and International Security. And in terms of command and control over Syria's chemical weapons and this unit 450 that we were just talking about a second ago that can fill them up in binary, if they have the sophisticated binary weapons, those are when the chemicals are kept separate and they're combined when the projectile is fired. Of course, those that are either apologizing or in denial about what Syria has done, the Russians and the regime itself, are saying it doesn't make any sense for Assad to do this, and ostensibly it doesn't make any sense. So do you have any understanding of why these weapons were used?
Well, I think there are a couple of clues, but at this point it's really just speculation. But there has been a longstanding rebel presence in the suburbs of Damascus, which we know has been a thorn in the side of the Assad regime. And for him not to be able to control his own capital definitely does not look good, does not help morale of his own forces, and that might be creating internal tensions within the regime. And so this might have been part of a concerted effort to finally cleanse the capital, which would be operationally significant, but also symbolically important that Assad is back in control of his own capital city. We do know that the chemical attack that happened was done in conjunction with a concerted conventional military effort as well to try and seize this territory and get the rebels out of the suburbs of Damascus. So this was not an isolated incident. This was not random. This was a calculated move that was coordinated and integrated with a bigger conventional military counterinsurgency operation as well.
So I take it, though, that first of all, I don't know that there's any military way, if this strike that's supposed to take place after this congressional vote sometime, I imagine, next week, there would be there's no military way to neutralize these arsenals, given the scope of what the Assad regime has.
The U.S. has tried to develop what are called agent defeat munitions for many years, and these are weapons that could neutralize a chemical or biological target. But the problem is that they are basically unproven and would not guarantee 100% safe disposal of the weapons that they're targeted at. So it's unlikely that the U.S. would be able to attack, let alone destroy, serious chemical weapons from the air. There are just still very significant risks of local contamination and even collateral damage that probably rule such targets off limits.
So if there's no military way to neutralize these weapons, would a military strike, in your opinion, increase the likelihood that more of them would be used?
Well, the other option is to go after the delivery systems, because even if you cannot go after the actual chemical bombs and missile warheads, you can still attack from the air and destroy the rocket launchers, the artillery, the aircraft, the Scud missiles. And without a delivery system, these weapons are not going to be of danger to the region or to the rebels as much. So I expect if there is a military operation that it will focus more on going after the delivery systems that the regime has rather than the actual chemical stockpile because of the problems with not being able to destroy it safely and reliably.
But wouldn't that change the configuration on the battlefield? That would be intervening. The assumption here is that this is a political attack by using military force for political objectives as opposed to military objectives, and that often it's been said that the U.S. doesn't really want to get involved in this war. If you got involved to the extent that you knocked out their Air Force and all their delivery systems, then you would really be tipping the balance, wouldn't you, in favor of the rebels?
If you went to that extent, then yes, it would definitely tip the balance in favor of the rebels. But what I think Secretary Kerry, Secretary Hagel, and Chairman Dempsey have been saying is that one of their aims is to degrade Syrian delivery capabilities. So you don't have to destroy every last artillery tube or rocket launcher, but if you can destroy a significant amount, which would make it harder for him to launch chemical attacks, would also make it harder for him to launch conventional attacks against the rebels. And I think that is a, from the U.S. perspective, that's still a positive result of such military action. So I think it will remain limited. It will take in those types of targets into account, but not to the extreme of trying to use it to actually tip the balance fundamentally on the battlefield. But there would definitely be knock-on effects, or as Secretary Kerry said, downstream effects on the regime's ability to attack the rebels.
Well, isn't there also what will obviously happen is that the U.S. will be changing the subject. I mean, at this point, it's the Assad regime that have crossed the line and used weapons of mass destruction against their own people, which the last time that happened was Saddam's attack on the Kurds. That should be the subject, surely. The minute the U.S. attacks, won't the whole narrative change? The whole world will be once again saying, there's the United States attacking some poor, beleaguered third world country.
There's certainly a risk of that, but I think the severity and magnitude of what the Assad regime has done in killing 110,000 of its own people, I don't think there's that much sympathy for the regime to start with. The chemical weapon attacks are pretty well documented. You can see very sadly graphic pictures and videos of what the effects of these chemical weapons are. And these are not weapons being used on the battlefield, right? Whole families were killed by these nerve agents while they were sleeping. So I don't think the idea of the Assad regime being the victim of a bully, I just don't think that, I think most reasonable people will see through that. And that's not something that will get a lot of resonance. I think that the fact that a dictator is using weapons that 98% of the world has signed on to a treaty saying these weapons are, you know, inhumane, barbaric, have no place in a civilized nation. I think most people would support the idea that these weapons should not be used. And so the actions the U.S. takes to try and enforce that norm and uphold it is something that actually benefits everyone, right? Protects everyone from chemical weapons. If one dictator is allowed to use these weapons, it only emboldens others to think that they can develop them and use them with impunity as well. So I think there is a broader story here. It's not just about Obama versus Assad or U.S. versus Syria. And I think it's important that that message gets out. And I think most people will appreciate that and understand that.
But in terms of morality and humanitarian values, we haven't seemed to care too much about the fact that 100,000 civilians, mostly civilians, have died so far. So why all of a sudden are we concerned about the loss of life in Syria?
Well, I think people have been concerned, and there's been a lot of pressure put on the Syrians and their allies to negotiate, to find a political settlement to the conflict. And clearly that has not worked, but I think there's been a lot of pressure there. And the U.S. has been, and other countries have been, trying to alleviate the humanitarian suffering caused by this civil conflict. But for good reasons, lots of countries have been very reluctant to intervene militarily in the civil war. So lack of military action does not mean lack of interest, but when you get involved militarily, it is as you said earlier, it is another level of commitment. And I think this chemical attack, which is not the only one that's happened, according to the British, it's happened 14 previous times. This was not an isolated incident. This was just the latest escalation by the regime, and using a weapon that 189 countries have outlawed, that is kind of the straw that broke the camel's back and is the immediate trigger, but it is on this background of all this other death and destruction that's occurred. So I think it has to be seen in that context. It's not an either-or. This was on top of it, and this is just what made it an unacceptable situation to continue as is.
But if this is just simply punishment for crossing a line, even though 100,000 people had died prior to this line being crossed, I mean, there are two avenues here. You can either find a way to negotiate your way out of this slaughterhouse, or you can try and end the slaughter by using greater force, for the want of a better description. So what's the point of a punitive attack then? If, you know, where is the morality of a punitive attack if you're really concerned about saving this country from itself?
Well, if this was just going to be a purely symbolic pinprick attack, then it would not, I think, be the proper response. At the same time, you do not need to, you know, invade the country of Syria in order to have influence on the outcome of the fight now between the regime and the opposition. There's a lot in the middle, and I think that is what President Obama and the Congress have been trying to find, is what is the right balance between supporting U.S. national security interests, upholding this global prohibition against the use of chemical weapons, and trying to help the opposition secure their freedom from the Assad regime. And that is a tricky balance. Some countries want to go further. Some countries want to do less. But it's now the point where the regime is acting in such a way that this is no longer an issue that can be put off and put off and put off. And I think that's why we are coming up to this, you know, this fundamental turning point in the conflict here.
But one of the things that would seem that the U.S. and Russia has in common here, and after all, the president will be in Russia on Thursday and Friday. He won't be meeting with Putin after the G20, which in retrospect, it sounds like he should be meeting with Putin, because my understanding is that the U.S. and Russia have this simple thing in common, which is neither wants Syria to end up in the hands of an al-Qaeda-affiliated group like the al-Nusra Front that appear to be the most effective fighting force on the rebel side. So isn't there a common interest here?
There is, and the idea that you want to have a moderate regime take power that is not dominated by jihadists or similar groups is definitely a shared interest. And to the extent that the U.S. and Russia and its other allies can agree on that desired end state, then they can try and work backwards to figure out what do we need to do now to get there. And so hopefully this will be on the agenda at the meeting. Hopefully the U.S. and the Russians will talk about it either bilaterally or multilaterally. And even though Russia has opposed U.S. Use of force and threatened to veto anything in the Security Council, there is a shared interest here. So the extent that they can focus on that, there might be some progress that we see in the course of this meeting coming up.
And would that be sufficient, do you think, to make it unnecessary to pull the trigger? In other words, use the maximum leverage of a threat of a strike against Syria to stop these people from killing each other, because apparently they really hate each other and there's blood on all of their hands and they're just spiraling into the abyss.
I mean, these types of conflicts are not necessarily driven by ancient hatreds that never change. There are facts on the ground that that trigger political violence, And if you can change the facts, then the incentives for violence go away. So it is possible, and we've seen this in conflicts in the Balkans, in North Africa, in other countries, where you can remove the conditions that are causing the conflict. So there are ways to deal with once Assad leaves office, how do you then organize the governance of the country? And that there are many different forms that can take, and it's a matter of what is the combination of power sharing, assurances to former members of the regime that that they will receive amnesty or reconciliation. To what extent is there a reconstruction effort that all members of Syria, all different ethnicities and nationalities, can benefit from? So there are lots of things that can be done aside from that are not dealing with these immutable so-called ancient hatreds that have just been kept in check by Assad's iron fist. So by no means are there any simple solutions here, but there's more, I think, room in the gray here for both sides to reach some kind of negotiated settlement.
Well, Gregory Coblentz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Gregory Coblentz, who is a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs and deputy director of the Biodefense Graduate Program at George Mason University. He's also a research affiliate with the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a member of the Scientists Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Living Weapons, Biological Warfare, and International Security. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into alternative scenarios to a punitive strike against Syria.